For those of you who haven't read my abstract or who actually here for the great talk on cholera or sanitation that we just heard, let me explain. So I actually currently live in Banda Aceh, Indonesia, where I work for the American Red Cross. But prior to working with American Red Cross, it was with Oxfam. And this presentation is basically based on an assessment I did while working for Oxfam. And it is simply a snapshot of 15 barracks in Banda Aceh and Aceh Besar 2 years after the tsunami. And it's not meant to be indicative of the entire situation post-tsunami, but just this one capture in time. And I'll talk about kind of what we learned by doing this. Our results were different than we had expected, and I think it's really important sometimes that public health is such a broad topic, so you end up coming up with different results than you think you do. So let me start, because I'm a Hopkins grad, I just love surveys too much. So let me start by, if I could survey the audience here. How many of you have worked with displaced persons? If you could just raise your hand for me. Okay. How many of you have worked with tsunami-affected populations? Okay. And have any of you worked or lived in Banda Aceh, Indonesia? So there's no one here to keep me honest. I think you'll keep me partially honest. Okay. So let me start. I'm sure much of you have heard some of the basic backgrounds. In 2004, in December, there was a large earthquake followed by a tsunami, which many of you know. Prior to that, there had been 29 years of conflict in Aceh. In 2005, so right at the come into the new year, they find 130,000 people have died in Aceh province alone. 300,000 people are displaced. And the government of Indonesia responded by building temporary barracks, which we're going to pictured in the upper left-hand corner there. And they house 65,000 people. I think it's really interesting to know that that means that the remainder of the population really was absorbed within their own communities or with family members, which I think is quite impressive and talks about the resilience of the Acehese people. In 2007, the status was very different. Okay, there's now a peace agreement, and before, when these barracks were built, they really are called barracks, just like military barracks, and there was some concern, really on the part of NGOs, maybe we don't want to get involved in this, maybe this is forced relocation, and at some points there were armed guards at some of the barrack locations, and are people being watched, is this a war thing? But by 2007, there's a peace agreement in place, and the barrack leases are ending because they were just meant to be 2 years. They thought they'd get the houses situated by then, and they had not. And the physical conditions were really deteriorating. So at this point, Oxfam decided maybe we should relook at this question of whether we should be involved or not, and what are the real issues in the barracks, and how should we deal with this. So we did a survey, basically really hoping to focus where were we gonna put our efforts. We wanted to quantify the water and sanitation situation and evaluate the hygiene knowledge, attitudes, and practices of barrack residents and assess the existing local and national government policies. We used a variety of methods. I won't go through everything there. We did a lot. But in the end, we ended up doing household surveys in over 25% of the households in our 15 barracks. And we actually even did better in the 10 that we were focusing on. So I feel like we got a lot of data. So let me start by sharing kind of some of that data. Except that I think it's about to skip a slide on me. Maybe we'll get it to stay for a second. Okay, so who lives in the barracks? 42% of the people who we interviewed reported a decrease in household size due to death from the tsunami. 57% were household motorcycle owners. If you look at the corner in the upper left-hand corner, you can see that there's nice four people on that one motorcycle, which is also a public health concern. 63% were former home owners. 34% had changed their occupation from before the tsunami. And the average person reported an income between $2.50 and $4.50 a day. And we actually found, CARE did a study and found that the average income in Aceh is about $5.50 per day. So whether the income is actually less for those who were living in the barracks or whether it's just a case of self-reporting income versus, I was never able to find out how CARE had collected their data. And so I can't really draw sweeping conclusions from that, but I would not be surprised if the mean income of those in the barracks is significantly less or slightly less than those in the general population. I want to start because we're talking about water and sanitation, and I starting with hygiene knowledge, because as many of you know, hygiene knowledge, and then I'll move into sanitation, and then water quantity, and then water quality, kind of in the order of which your intervention really will make a difference in the end outcomes, the end health outcomes. So, starting with hygiene knowledge, I don't want to bore you with too many statistics, so I actually have a paper. There's some copies on the outside, and anyone who's interested, I can give you the whole paper that has way too many statistics on everything we learned about people. But I think there's some interesting conclusions here. First of all, we found that an impressive 86% of people knew that the reason they boiled their water was to kill germs. We also found that 69% of people could themselves define the relationship between poor hygiene and illness. So that was quite impressive. There's a really good baseline of information there among people. But we found some other areas that were maybe more lacking. People didn't have very much information on dengue, and they also lacked information on malaria. So I want to talk about one other thing on that slide. One of the most interesting things we found, I was working for Oxfam. And for those of you who know Oxfam, it's very important to gender desegregate your data and look at everything as a gender and how it plays into everything. And this was one of the only areas where we actually found that there was a strong, there was any significant difference when I ran all the different correlations and data, and this was the only one that I found. Really, unfortunately, men had a significantly better, sometimes 2.9 times more likely to answer hygiene knowledge questions correctly than women, which is a huge finding. So moving on to sanitation. In the barracks, we found that 40% of the latrines were unusable. And this can sound so bad, but really, we found that was enough because of decreased population in the barracks as people were moving out, as they were getting homes, that there were actually enough to meet SPHEAR standards. For those of you who are unfamiliar with SPHEAR, SPHEAR is basically humanitarian guidelines, and it's usually, we use it kind of post-disaster. And so perhaps we shouldn't be using SPHEAR standards. It's now 2 years after the disaster, and perhaps it's not really fair to say, oh, you should still be, you know, living at the minimum standards. But I do feel that because people were moving out as well, we felt like SPHEAR is probably an okay guideline for us to be using as minimum. So there were lots of unusable latrines, but if we locked them up, then we felt like there was enough. Almost every family had their own private latrine, so, and they were initially built as shared latrines. So, we also found a positive impact of NGOs active in the barracks. And maybe that shouldn't seem like a big deal, but we actually, initially, I looked at a huge data set from UNICEF, who had all the basically used and usable and damaged and clean latrines kind of data versus how many people the NGO is working on it. And I found no significant difference whether an NGO was working in the barrack or not. And that made me a little sad because the NGOs are spending a lot of money to be in the barracks. But what we found when we did our more intensive study of just 15 barracks was that those barracks where there was an NGO currently active, the hygiene condition was actually better. And so what I think this may mean is that, unfortunately, NGOs have no residual effect. If they were there a year ago and have now moved on, despite their efforts to be sustainable, it doesn't look like it worked. But if an NGO was active in the barrack at that time, then there was improved sanitation situation. I talked in my abstract. So for those of you who read the abstract, I said I'd mention water testing methods. So I feel like I need to just talk about it really quickly, that I tried to use three different kinds. And the WagTech, I'm not sure how familiar you are with these, but WagTech and the H2S strip test bottles, we got free from UNICEF. Unfortunately, the WagTech kit never once produced any positive results at all. So we kind of figured after a while that I think it's the kit. We had two different kits, and neither of them worked. So it could either be just that incubator or what, but so we unfortunately weren't able to use that. And for those of you who are familiar, the H2S strip bottles are very easy. All you do is put water in it, and the family themselves can keep it, and then 3 days later can look and say, oh my gosh, it's brown, that means I have fecal coliforms in my water, or it's clear, that means it's all good. The problem is that they actually have a lot of false positives. So in an area like the United States, maybe, where you wouldn't really expect that much fecal coliforms in your water, we could give them out to everyone, and then the few that got positive results we could retest. Unfortunately, as I'll show you in our next slide, we had a lot of positive results. So having false positives really meant almost everyone came back black. So this caused a lot of problems. So we actually relied most heavily on the Del-Aqua kit, which uses a membrane filtration method. And we found it's a little harder to use. We have to have a trained lab. You know, we had our lab technician do it, but we felt like it was the most reliable method. We could have used something like MPN, the most probable number, but it's just too expensive to ship things away to a lab. So we felt like for us, the Del-Aqua kit worked as the best in-field fecal coliform test. So here are the results from the water. Well, first let me talk about water quantity. We actually were asking lots of questions. How much water did you collect yesterday? But we quickly discovered that everyone had well over the 20 liters per person per day required by Sphere. Everyone, there was access, there was wells, and that people actually would bathe at. So it made it very difficult to count some sort of number. And so we just felt like, in the end, people actually had a very large quantity of water. Unfortunately, it looks like the quality of water was quite poor. So as you can see, 47% of the samples came back with some fecal coliforms. WHO, the Sphere, and the government of Indonesia all require zero fecal coliforms in their standards. But I went ahead and disaggregated it there by different lengths because sometimes WHO used to allow some fecal coliforms, so they just updated their standards. What we found while doing our study, so I'm public health, I'm engineering background, and we were really excited about doing water sanitation in the barracks, but what we found was actually that the most important thing to people in the barracks was not the public health, and while the public health situation wasn't great, it actually met Sphere standards. It wasn't horrific. And we found, though, that 51% of barrack residents did not know when their barrack would be taken down. The government was in the process of decommissioning them, and nobody knew. Like, just the broad range within one building, we would ask, and from 2 years from now to next month, nobody knew. So, okay. The other big result we found that was only 26% of the households in our 15 barracks had housing commitments, according to BRR, which is the government of Indonesia, on the ground there, records. So the huge problem, at least that we felt in the end, was actually not the public health situation, but more these larger policy issues and what's going to happen in the future. So we concluded that really we needed to increase the policy team involvement rather. We needed to really encourage the government to have a maintenance strategy in the barracks, to formalize the barrack decommissioning plan, and to inform residents where and when they were moving. And I am happy to say that I feel like, it's not perfect, but I feel like all of those actually were able to move forward a little bit. The government does have a maintenance plan. Now that I'm actually at American Red Cross, it's very funny because the government actually writes me these letters saying, hey, can you come? We're going to reconsolidate people into this barrack, so can you guys come clean this one up or maintain this one? I'm very excited that the government has really taken ownership over that. They've also formalized the barrack decommissioning plan, and it's a continuously updated document. They've also informed residents about where and when they're going to be moving. Now, they give them 15 days advance notice, which compared to the 15 minutes some people were getting before their building was leveled, this is phenomenal. We're very excited. So, for our program as well, we felt like we needed to target our hygiene promotion. People have a lot of knowledge already, so we really did targeted campaigns on those things that people needed to learn. And just like in the United States, we all have plenty of things that we still need to learn. So we felt like targeted hygiene promotion was the best way to go. And then we worked on a maintenance focus rather than a new construction focus. We felt like there was enough of what was there. We just needed to maintain those facilities that were there. I just want to say one thing. The other thing that maybe conclusions for now is that there are only 3,000 people now. When we did this study, it was February 2007, and now there are actually only 3,000 households left in the barracks. Compared to the 18,000 people still living in temporary living centers in New Orleans, I think that Indonesia is doing pretty darn well. Thank you.